You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of these crises. My name is Matt Bodker, and I'm joined with, once again, just my one Kistler friend, Dr. Stephen Kistler, an epidemiologist at Harvard School of Public Health. Good morning to you, fine sir. How are you doing in this lovely Monday morning?
Good morning. I'm doing pretty well. It's really hot in Boston today, so we're just trying to keep cool however we can.
Oh, man. But, yeah. You were at the beach, weren't you, just this weekend?
Yeah, right? if you can call it that. So New England does have things that some people refer to as beaches. They're pretty rocky, and water is very cold. But it was nevertheless, you know, since it is driving distance away, it was nice to just get out of the city for a little bit. So.
That's awesome. Good. My weekend was spent dealing with sciatica. I was telling Stephen, this has been fun. I'm 43 years old. I'm getting old, apparently. And so now I got some sciatica problem. I didn't do anything strange or crazy. I just got it. So I don't know how it happened. And so it's been fun. It's been great. I just don't want to sit down. Don't want to lay down. I wish I could sleep standing up. Yeah. That'd be a great thing to do. Or like a little bat upside down. So that's been mine. But it's been beautiful here, beautiful weather. And that's good to get outside with the boys and do more things, all that great stuff. And I hope you guys are listening, having a wonderful summer as well, and getting ready for a wonderful 4th of July for those of you who celebrate here in the US of A. But let's get going here. So a couple things. Reviews, love them. We just got another one last week. It was awesome. Thank you so much. I wanted to read that, but I forgot to put it in the show notes. I'll do it next time around. Just as I'm remembering, Stephen is going to be gone next week, so we'll probably either skip, just let you guys know ahead of time, or if I can get this elusive, I don't know what his name is again, Mark Kistler or something like that, Dr. Mark, if I get him actually on the show again, maybe we can have another episode. But he is one heck of a busy man. If you want to support us, we'd love it. It helps us just keep us going, put a few cents in our pockets, help to automate things and allow us to continue to move this forward. That's at patreon.com/pandemicpodcast or one-time gift, PayPal, Venmo, all in the show notes. So I want to start with this. This is kind of not necessarily COVID related, Stephen, but I just want to get an idea of how, you know, global warming affects your research and infectious disease. Because the reason why I'm thinking about this is I just saw this on the news like 3 days ago. It was like a record temperature. I couldn't believe like Portland. I don't know if you saw this, Stephen, like predicted. I don't know if it hit it like 114 degrees in Portland, Oregon. And Seattle was supposed to get upwards of 100, which this is not like 10 to 15 degrees. This is 30 to 40 degrees over their normal highs. And so this got me thinking of how does an increase in temperature globally affect disease? You know, in my mind, does it make it worse? Does it make it less? I'm sure it's complicated, like everything. Cause I'm thinking, you know, wintertime is when it gets really difficult for us. And so I'm like, when it gets colder, maybe it gets worse. And when it gets warmer, maybe things will be generally better. But is that, I'm guessing everything is nuanced. There's no black and white, but how do you approach this when it comes to future diseases?
Yeah. So this is a great question and something that a lot of epidemiologists are working on right now is the intersection between climate change and infectious disease. So I think, you know, there are a couple different levels that we can take a look at this question. And I think I'll sort of step from maybe the most apparent ones down to some of the maybe more surprising ones as well. So of course, one of the issues with global warming is, as the name says, you know, places get warmer. And so one of the things that we are already beginning to see and will probably continue to see is that the regions where, you know, basically the tropical bands of the climate tropical bands of the world that are generally the middle latitudes are starting to expand outwards. And that has an effect on a couple of different ways. So first of all, different infectious diseases frequently behave differently in tropical versus temperate parts of the world. So flu is the canonical example where in temperate regions of the world, we see major wintertime outbreaks of many respiratory diseases. Whereas in the tropical regions of the world, where seasons are not so much spring, summer, winter, fall, but more rainy and dry, the whole pattern of flu outbreaks and other respiratory illnesses is just different. It tends to be a lot more sporadic. Still can be linked to the seasons, but again, the seasons look very different there than they do, for example, up here in Boston. And so what we're starting to see is there's sort of the latitudes where that region exists are starting to expand. And it's going to be interesting to see what effect that has on the overall seasonality of respiratory illnesses, the severity of respiratory illnesses. Because in some ways, having outbreaks asynchronous can be helpful in a way, because when everyone's susceptible and then gets infected in one big explosive outbreak, that actually tends to cause more cases than it does when people are sort of getting infected at a low level over time. That's certainly not an argument to say that global warming is a good thing, because we actually don't know what some of these effects are going to be. One of the other things that happens when you have this expanding latitudes of sort of tropical regions is that a lot of the vectors that carry other infectious diseases that are especially problems in tropical areas of the world, especially mosquitoes, they're starting to expand their habitats outward as well. So that's part of why we were able to see, for example, sort of more widespread outbreaks of Zika virus a few years back, because the range where those mosquitoes that carry that virus can thrive are wider than they used to be. And so we're going to start to see outbreaks of infectious diseases like malaria, for example, in places that haven't seen them for many years. We've started to see outbreaks of malaria in southern Italy, for example, which had eradicated malaria for a very long period of time. So this is going to start to become a reality. We're going to see infectious diseases that certain parts of the globe have not seen in a very long time start to resurge. So that's one key area that we're thinking about. But of course, now, global warming, you know, we think about it in terms of warming and of places getting hotter, but actually, you know, one of the biggest problems with global warming is not so much the increase in temperature, but the increase in variation in the types of weather systems that you get. So you generally get stronger storms, you get hotter hots, but you also tend to get colder colds as well. And so it just makes sort of the whole weather system a lot more variable. And so one of the issues there too is that, of course, for infectious diseases in places where that do remain temperate, you might actually see much more severe winters and much more severe summers, which could actually drive that seasonality even stronger. And then sort of digging one layer deeper into that, one of the things that I'm most concerned about is that we've definitely seen, and we're beginning to see, and I anticipate that we'll continue to see big increases in the severity of tropical storms, hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, you know, things that can really devastate coastal communities. And so, you know, one of the other big issues is that we're going to start to see infectious disease crises that follow along when these things hit shore. So a number of years back, we saw there was a major hurricane that hit Haiti in the Dominican Republic. And following on from that, for years, they've been having a really difficult time controlling cholera because that affected their water treatment system. And so there's been this huge cholera outbreak that has been spreading there as a result of a hurricane that hit. Yeah. And so as we start to see coastlands getting flooded, different infrastructures are going to cause, you know, start to collapse. We're going to see people displaced, which also causes sort of the spread of pathogens. And so there's a lot of really big issues that are going to follow along from this that include, you know, the ways that diseases spread because of the changing weather, but also include the very humanitarian crises that are going to follow along from global warming as well. So it's hard to overstate how huge of an issue this is and how it will touch infectious diseases and every other part of our lives in every way. But yeah, it's not to be a, you know, I feel bad starting off the podcast on this note. It seems so bleak. It is, but you know, we have a lot of work to sort of get this more under control.
Yeah, I'm assuming, Stephen, do you work much with like climate change specialists there, or do you kind of your own bubble? Given that, you know, what you do seems to touch almost every dimension of reality, do you have like little groups by which you kind of talk about the future of global warming and how people are, or how best to handle it? Or how does that work for you when it comes to collaboration?
Yeah, so I'm not working with any climate scientists, although back when I was studying for my PhD, I did a little bit more so. Many of my colleagues are, for sure. There's a lot of crosstalk between climate scientists and epidemiologists, economists and epidemiologists. That's one of the areas that I've been sort of doing more interdisciplinary collaboration, behavioral scientists and epidemiologists. So oftentimes it's really difficult to sort of have any sort of expertise in all of these realms at once. So frequently, we epidemiologists will sort of pick one or two that seem especially related to the work that we're doing and try to dig into that and develop collaborations there. But absolutely, since climate change is such a huge issue, there are a lot of us who've been talking with climate scientists and really thinking deeply about what these changes are going to mean for the landscape of public health.
Sure. You know, this is, we're going to change subject now, but I feel like it's kind of related. It's kind of hard to put my finger on this, but there's this other article I want to talk about, but it's kind of maybe in a metaphorical way, it's related. This man believed to have longest COVID-19 infection had virus for 300 days. So why do I think this is related? Because I feel like in some sense with global warming, no matter how much the world begins to have its own ecosystem, in the end, and how it corrects itself, in the end, there is some dependency and responsibility on us to be able to help it be able to not go into an extreme weather cycle or whatever. And so the same thing for this, where this was fascinating to me because this guy had it for 300 days. It's like, whoa, that's insane. How does that happen? The article obviously right away kind of popped that bubble for people. You got freaked out about, oh my gosh, can people just spread it for 300 days? No, this was just an individual person who had a severe immune compromised body, cancer, that kind of stuff. So that kept the virus alive for a long period of time. And I want you to speak into this for a second, because this was like a revelation to me on maybe at least the current technology that's provided for us, that no matter how much medicine, future technology that we have to help bring health to someone who's sick, in the end, the buck stops with us, because I realize, oh, this person just couldn't receive the treatment because the body itself wasn't able to work with the treatment. I'm like, wow, at some level, we can really put our hope in technology that it's going to cure every disease. But it looks, at least at this moment, this is a perfect case by which the body has to have at least a baseline by which to negotiate and work with the future technology to bring about health. And that just was kind of a revelation to me that, again, going back to the public health mandates of the future technology is great, but at the same time, we've got to keep ourselves as healthy as possible to work with technology and not have it be kind of like a substitute for our bad behaviors and bad health.
Yeah. And to be clear, like, certainly being immunocompromised does not relate to necessarily bad behavior or like any person's fault. People are certainly born with these conditions. Cancer is no one's fault. And so maintaining our health is a good thing to do, and helps, you know, not just with the standard things of preventing, you know, reducing our risk of cancer and obesity, but also then the downstream conditions that follow along from that, which include bad outcomes from infectious diseases. So I do have a lot of hope for the technologies, the medical technologies that will develop in the future, and that hopefully, you know, we will find ways to help people who are immunocompromised to improve their immune systems, to have, you know, immunotherapy, to find vaccines that work for them. There's been some recent studies that suggest maybe a third dose of the mRNA vaccines actually do provide a substantially higher immunity for people who have certain immunocompromised conditions. So that might be an approach, is to just sort of keep exposing them repeatedly to the vaccines, and that might help. So I think this is a really active area of research. You're right as well that on sort of the population level too, and I think we'll probably get into this in some of the topics that we'll talk about in a few moments as well, but we can place so much of our trust in technology. And I've seen this especially around the vaccine, sort of like seeing the vaccine as this magic bullet that will get us out of the COVID problem. And that's clearly not the case too, right? We're seeing spikes in cases in places around the world. And again, since people are vaccinated, these rises in cases don't necessarily mean what they meant 6 or 8 months ago. They're not translating into hospitalizations and deaths at nearly the same rate that they did then. So the vaccines are definitely doing what they were intended to do, but they're also, you know, COVID is still clearly here. And there are other things, including, you know, basic prevention measures that are still important alongside the vaccine. And you're right, you know, like in the long term, one of the things we talked about in previous episodes was just like how the United States in particular does have really high rates of obesity, heart disease, diabetes, some of these things which are, you know, are genetically linked, but are also to some extent behaviorally linked. And so, you know, what can we do to maintain a healthy society to the extent that we're able? If you're predisposed to diabetes and obesity, how can we help those people out a little bit extra? Because they're going to have an especially hard time keeping their weight down. And that's going to, you know, make them especially vulnerable to future infectious diseases too. You know, how do we, you know, treat the whole person and the whole body and not just rely on sort of these technologies to come through and save us in a time of crisis? I think that that's a huge, huge thing that we're going to have to think about for the future of public health.
Yeah. No, thank you for correcting my oversimplification. Yep, totally. With the immunocompromised, that is not anybody's fault. And I'm just thinking about back in my 90s days, we're trying to lose weight, and there was these pills you could take that actually would make you feel full, so you don't have to eat. I'm like, that's like the cheap way, right? Like not trying to actually work and actually being healthy, but taking some kind of chemical pill to make you actually feel full, so then you don't overeat. I mean, these are the things we need to really work on in general health. Right. No, thank you for that clarification. Right. Okay, so let's get into this now. So with the Delta, the variant we're seeing now, I mean, last week, I saw a lot of articles about this kind of a little bit of dramatic stuff going on, and maybe not fear mongering, but just showing a lot of rising cases everywhere. We're seeing the Delta variant being really taking over California. not necessarily in the sense of like surges, but just that it's dominant. It's now, I forgot what it was, like 1%. Now it's like 15% or more than that within California being the Delta variant. Missouri seeing a surge of the Delta. Seems like the Delta variant's contributing to that. We're seeing Africa now. You said, you mentioned even the UK is starting to see. Israel, you know, at 87% vaccinated, is starting to see, you know, quote, a surge. Now we can talk about that right now or in a little bit about how the 100 cases that they've received a day, half of those coming from children who are unvaccinated. But surprisingly, the other half, at least as one article is saying, is coming from vaccinated adults. You know, so these are these breakthrough occurrences. You know, maybe you can speak on all of this at one level of where you see things both as the Delta variant kind of taking over certain areas and how we're going to continue seeing these hot pockets. But also this idea of the breakthrough, yeah, hot pockets.
I said, that's great. I'm going to use that for
not. Oh, sorry. Man, I'm 43. Those were the most delicious thing ever. That's a good use of hot pockets, by the way. No. So talk about that, of those hot spots, right? And as well as this Israel dealing with these 100 cases, 87% vaccinated. So it's going to land on a few and what that means for the breakthroughs.
Yeah. Right. So I think that we can sort of think about this on two different levels where, you know, one, there are many countries around the world where vaccination rates remain very low. And so in those contexts, you know, then there's not so much a question as, why is it spreading there? Because it's sort of the same old song and dance in a way where it's like, it just happened then. And yeah. we do have the Delta variant on our hands, which is, as we mentioned, I think in the last episode, far more infectious, potentially is able to get around some level of underlying immunity anyway. And so it makes a lot of sense that places who don't really have much immunological protection from the vaccine or from a lot of previous spread would be susceptible to rises in cases right now. So that's one thing. Then we certainly have the example of places that have higher vaccination rates as well. Why is the Delta variant starting to spread there too? So sort of ticking these off one by one, if we're able. I think also, as we've mentioned before, you know, vaccination rates, it matters a lot sort of what geographic scale you look at them on. So across the United States, we have, I think, on the order of almost 50% of people fully vaccinated, something on that order. Mm-hmm. And more than that who have received at least one dose. But of course, that varies hugely from community to community. So a lot of places where we've seen outbreaks of the Delta variant now are still hovering around 15-20% vaccination rates. And so there's still a lot of susceptibility there too. And of course, there's still COVID circulating in the community. Like there are still cases spreading around. And so when it finds a place where it's able to spread, it's going to spread. And so that makes some sense. But of course, you know, there's, as you said, we are still seeing cases even in vaccinated people. We are still seeing cases in places where we do have high rates of vaccination. And so what's going on there? On the one hand, it seems like the vaccines are working as we would expect, right? Like the vaccines are highly effective, but again, they have 95% effectiveness against symptomatic disease against the sort of vanilla variant. This was even pre-alpha variant that most of the mRNA vaccines were tested. And so we will see some breakthrough infections. It's going to chip away at that effectiveness against symptomatic disease. It'll chip away probably even more against the effectiveness against asymptomatic disease, which was already a little bit lower in the first place. And so we're going to start seeing breakthrough infections. We're going to start seeing the Delta variant take over even in places that do have high rates of vaccination, including California. No matter what your rates of vaccination are, the Delta will start to displace whatever was there because it's just so much more infectious. That's just the way that evolutionary biology works. It's going to start making up more and more of those cases, even if it doesn't necessarily cause surges. And that sort of brings us to the UK, which has had a pretty good vaccination rollout program, but is starting to see both, you know, the majority of cases made up by the Delta variant and rise in cases in many places. Now, the UK, similar to the US, has a lot of heterogeneity in vaccination rates within the country. Some places are very highly vaccinated, some still have very low rates of vaccination, but we're starting to see rises in cases. Again, I think the main point to underscore here is that it's not totally unexpected, although it's something that we're watching, you know, very closely. I want to see how this sort of plays out. But by and large, you know, again, people who are vaccinated are very well protected against severe disease. And so even if the variant is able to gain a foothold, even if it's able to spread, it's not translating into hospitalizations and deaths at nearly the rate that previous variants were in the pre-vaccine era. So, you know, this is kind of something that we've been saying for over a year now, which is that, you know, we're going to be living with COVID for a very long time. And we're sort of in this awkward transition period where hopefully it's transitioning from this pandemic awful disease to something that is more like a wintertime respiratory virus. And we're still going to see these sort of surges of infection at different times of year until things sort of settle out. It's going to take a little while for that system to sort of settle into its normal, you know, pattern of seasonal outbreaks, which is what I imagine will probably happen. We could be surprised. It might be able to spread outside of the winter and for a long time to come. But we're still in that transition period. So none of what we're seeing is super alarming to me, although it is, you know, something we need to pay close attention to, because, you know, if we do start to see really big rises in cases, for example, in the UK or in Israel, and if those do start translating into hospitalizations and deaths, which I don't anticipate that it will, but if it does, in that, you know, remote possibility that it does, then we've got some more work on our hands. You know, we've got to continue, you know, figuring this out. But for right now, you know, watching it with curiosity, but definitely not panicking.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. And to put things into context, just to say from the CDC, this is like 4,100 cases total so far in the US that have led to breakthroughs and hospitalization and or death. And of those, like, I think it was 3,900 have been hospitalized, and 1,000 of those 3,900 were asymptomatic and really unrelated to COVID-19, the CDC says, as well as 750 fully vaccinated people have also died. I think most were the age of over 65 in that situation. Of those 750, 142 of those were, again, asymptomatic and not really directly correlated to COVID. So it just shows how small the percentage, which seems to be going quite accurate with what we think of between 94% to 98% with effective with the Delta variant with Pfizer and Moderna, yeah. Right? So it seems to be right on par with all that.
Yeah, that's perfect. I do want to amend a previous statement where I said that I'm not particularly concerned, and that really pertains to highly vaccinated communities. I am deeply, deeply concerned about what may happen in places that don't have high rates of vaccination yet, because, you know, especially with the Delta variant, we know that it could potentially be more severe as well. And so I think this really underscores the super urgency sharing vaccines, of getting as many places around the globe vaccinated as quickly as possible, both for their own sake, for the sake of the global picture. Because again, I'm sitting up here in Massachusetts, where we have very high vaccination rates and cases are very low right now. So in that context, I'm not particularly concerned for this local community, but we do still have a massive global problem on our hands. And I just want to underscore that and not be too blasé about any of that.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah. But yeah, you know, we're talking about just like Africa, because I'm 1% vaccinated right now, and they're seeing a pretty big surge. And this could be really destructive for Africa and a lot of these countries who don't have the resources like we do to be able to roll out such a vaccinated effort across the country. So let's keep going with this Delta thing. What do you think about this? I read this article, kind of got me really interested about it. Delta variant can spread within 5 to 10 seconds of exposure. So, you know, that was like, whoa, that freaked me out. Because of course, you know, we've talked about this, it was 10 to 15 minutes or 15 minutes of exposure. We've evolved that over time, that it's not 15 minutes in individual increments, but it's a total of 15 minutes over a period of day, you know, over one day. I know we in the US really like numbers and algorithms to know exactly what we can do. So we can basically go right to that line and have our freedom and then not cross that line. So is this something that's just like, qualitatively different with the Delta variant, that it's just so bad that if I'm with someone for 5 seconds, I'm toast? Or help kind of part this in comparison to the previous 10 to 15 minute one.
Yeah. So I think this is great. So it's so tricky, because we essentially, I think that the danger that we have in interpreting these numbers is that we're sort of comparing two things that sound similar, but I think in fact are not. So the 15 minute rule sort of is a question of average, of central tendency, of rough probabilities, where for the previous COVID variants, it was a rough sense of what's safe. Maybe 15 minutes of exposure in a room with somebody who has COVID is where you cross some threshold of likelihood of getting infected with COVID-19. But we're then comparing that with what I think is in this other study, which is a lower bound, which is basically how quickly could you possibly get the Delta variant? And it's within seconds. So that was true previously too. Like you could get infected with COVID no matter what variant, if somebody who is actively infectious coughed in your face. Like that would take right there, done. You know, like you've got
one COVID, second. Right?
And so, so I think that it's one of the things, and this is a lesson that I'm continuing to learn, even as a trained epidemiologist is just how much context matters and sort of what's around all of these statistics, because they become totally uninterpretable unless we know exactly where they were measured, how they were measured, what question they were aiming to answer. And so, you know, that's not to say, you know, it is true that the Delta variant is absolutely more infectious. And I do imagine that, you know, if you're comparing like with like situations in one room where you might have gotten infected in 15 minutes with the vanilla variant, I don't even know what to call it. It doesn't even have a Greek letter, but it's just like the standard coronavirus variant. Maybe you'll get infected with Delta sooner. How much sooner? I don't know. Maybe 15, you know, we can roughly work some of these probabilities out, right? If we think that Delta is maybe twice as infectious as the standard variant, maybe it takes half the time, something like that, but there's some sort of weird scaling. Yeah. You know, 15 to 7 minutes maybe is probably a more accurate sort of comparison there. But of course, you know, no amount of time is perfectly safe. Also, no amount of time is a guarantee that you'll get infected either. You could, you know, we've absolutely had people, you know, spend long, long periods of time in a room with another person who's actively infectious. But if there's ventilation, if there's masking, that might reduce the probabilities of infection down to very low. So all of this matters hugely. Definitely the Delta is more infectious, and that does translate into a shorter period of time on average that it will take for a person to become infected with Delta. But I don't think that it's a shift from tens of minutes to tens of seconds. It's probably, you know, tens of minutes to maybe 10 minutes.
Great. That's helpful. It puts it in perspective. That's totally right. It's always important to see the context. I forget it all the time. You get these articles, like one is the average, one is like as soon as 5 to 10 seconds, which of course that was in the old way as well. One small thing, again, before we move on from the Delta, even though it kind of permeates all of our discussions in one way or another, there is this Delta Plus variant. For those of you who heard of it, don't worry about it. I'll put this article in the show notes. It's, I don't know any of this. I'm just going to read the jargon. There's one small mutation. It's called the K4179. And apparently that is a number of other variants. So we can know that as being an insignificant mutation compared to what the Delta already. So no need to be alarmed if you see this in the news. It's not that significant whatsoever. Okay, so if there's two articles you guys read who are listening right now, these are the biggest articles I want you to read. I'm going to throw these past Stephen because the first one is this. They're both from The Atlantic. You're probably thinking I totally just am biased The Atlantic. I don't mean to be. I just happen to just read it. And I'm like, this is really good stuff. It could be one of those like blind coffee tasting tests, and I'd still end up being with The Atlantic because I just like the way it's written and it's just well done. So both of these are from The Atlantic. I'm sorry for not being diversified in my articles, but this is, are we ready for another pandemic? This is a must read. Everyone, please check it on the show notes, read it. But there's so much good stuff here about basically we're not and the reasons why and what we could have learned from the previous one. But instead of rehashing this, I want to throw it to you, Stephen. And thinking about going forward for the next pandemic, which is inevitable, if there was the top three things that we at least maybe not globally, maybe a top thing globally and three things in the U.S. that really needs to have a fundamental change for us to be able to appropriately handle the next pandemic, what would they be?
Oh, boy. Ask me on three different days and you'll get three different answers. And ask three different epidemiologists and none of them will agree. But I think part of that is just because there's so much to do and it's hard to sort of prioritize. But there's one of the things that this pandemic has really done is sort of underscored that something needs to be done. And I think that we're sort of actively working on sort of what that needs to be. So if I could take a stab at an answer at this, I think that one thing is changing the way that we do surveillance and communicate about potentially emerging biological threats. And that sounds complicated, and it's actually even more complicated than it sounds. Because so one of the issues is that, you know, we see spillovers of infectious diseases from animals to humans all the time. And actually spillover is probably not even the right word for it. We share infections with animals all the time. We acquire infections from poultry, from pigs, from whatever, but we also give them infections. There's a lot of, you know, flu is a great example where, you know, we're infecting pigs with our flu all the time and vice versa to some extent, you know, and the same is true for other, you know, other infectious diseases and other animals, other animal reservoirs. So I think we need to do probably more. We need to understand the human animal interface a little bit better. We need to understand sort of what's circulating in animals, what's circulating in humans, what are the things that have potential to spill over. But I think that this is a really difficult problem because not every infection that a human gets from an animal is going to cause a pandemic. Actually, you know, the number is the possibility that any given crossover does cause a pandemic is extremely, extremely low. And really all we end up seeing are these, you know, catastrophic events where we do see a global pandemic, but we forget that this happens all the time. So actually figuring out, you know, not only what's circulating there, what's crossing over into humans, but actually which are the things that we actually need to be concerned about and how do we become concerned about them quickly enough to do something about them, but without following up every single lead and, you know, completely exhausting ourselves, chasing our tails, is a really big open problem. And I think that's something that we're going to need to think about sort of as a global public health establishment. Okay, but what does that mean for, you know, those of us who are not epidemiologists and for, you know, who are, you know, don't want to live through another COVID-19, but also aren't going to set up some global immunological observatory that's going to test, you know, bats for, sure. For their antibodies. So I think that there's, I don't know how this works, but I think that sort of working on figuring out how to just emphasize the importance of preventive medicine is going to be really key. I think here in the United States, especially, we have this sense of sort of prioritizing crisis care over preventive care. We prefer to take a pill when we're sick than to do something to keep us from getting sick in the first place. And, you know, that's an oversimplification, but certainly I think that we could put more emphasis on, you know, what does it mean to keep ourselves healthy? And what does it mean for us to be agile to an infectious disease that's beginning to spread? How do we build the infrastructure to actually have the supplies for testing? How do we build the infrastructure to regulate tests and new diagnostics and things that need to be rolled out in a crisis period? Because our whole system is sort of based off of a non-crisis period. So how do we, you know, how do we build the resiliency into the FDA? How do we build the resiliency into our government? How do we build the resiliency into our individual behavior so that we can adapt to these sorts of things much more quickly? I don't have answers to any of those questions. I think I have more answers to sort of the regulatory and government level things than I do to the individual level stuff. But I think that that's a big, big question. It's like, how do we just sort of become more aware that these threats are going to continue happening? And how do we as individuals sort of incorporate that into our lives without sort of being crushed by this reality, but recognizing that, you know, it's in some ways, I think that it's a corrective in the right direction where we can so easily sort of partition illness and sickness and death into some corner of our lives and forget that we're not immortal. And, and I think this pandemic has been a real wake up call that, you know, in fact we are. And actually that's been a very clear realization for much of human history, but really we're kind of living in an odd period where we've been able to kind of ignore that in many ways in very well-resourced countries. So how do we sort of reincorporate this healthy notion of our physical limits, this healthy notion of our limited tenure of time on this earth without, you know, this is not a morbid thing. This is actually, you know, this is just sort of a realistic and I think a joyful thing that helps us to live our lives more fully in the moment anyway. But how do we do that gracefully, given all of the promise that technology has, given all of the ways that we've set up our societies to make it so that we can basically ignore this fact? What do we do? I don't know. But I think that's sort of the area that I think we're going to need a lot of work in the coming years.
Good. That's helpful. That's great. It remind me, or just makes me think of just the idea of the kind of like the tomorrow bias that we, not only as an individual, but obviously as a society, we're so prone to just as being humans, where me individually, tomorrow me is always going to be more productive, I'll start my diet tomorrow. I'll be more productive tomorrow. I'll sleep in tomorrow. I'll be kinder to my spouse and my kids tomorrow. And then today, just because, you know, there's a laundry list of the reasons why I just can't be that person that I want to be today because of the world around me is just putting pressure on me or whatever it is. And it just that cycle has to stop. And not to go in kind of a philosophical reality, but it just starts with the individual me of, look, I've got to start and I want to show my kids this as well. And I'm terrible at this, that no, the best person who can do this work, the best thing I can do is provide the best value for myself, my family today, and stop getting this vicious cycle of waiting till tomorrow before I do that thing a little bit better. Do better today, give myself, you know, tomorrow I'll start my walks. No, if I say that, then that means I have to double my walk today. I'm going to go out and for a walk today. And not, if I get tempted down that route, then the consequences is now I have to double my walk or double my salad and not having that piece of bread or whatever it is, because I've got to teach myself that today is the best day to change my life and not tomorrow. And then of course that just turns into government, social. We always want to postpone the inevitable to the future, but we've got to start by the individual level as well. That's great. Okay, so read that article from The Atlantic. It's so good. Second article, I think this is one we're going to end on. This is big because this was like a game changer for me as I read this, because we've talked so much, Stephen, about the efficacy of the mRNA, and I've been pushing you to talk about its nuances and its future and what it's going to provide and how I feel like it's going to save the world. And then here, Atlanta comes and busts my little bubble about mRNA, saying, look, this article is titled Novavax is now the best COVID-19 vaccine. So they're basically comparing Novavax to the mRNA and just saying, look, we are giving an unfair advantage to the mRNA vaccine, that we're not seeing a clear picture. At the end, they definitely hallmark mRNA, saying, no, this is a great technology. They're not saying this is bad. Their setup is, and I want you to respond back to this. Their setup is, look, mRNA became the premier vaccine really by accident, because basically Pfizer took BioNTech or whatever it is, took that and allowed that big corporation to help them move the needle forward. And they happened to be able to go through their phases during really big outbreaks, which allowed it to expedite. It was the outbreaks that expedited their mRNA vaccine to come to reality. And they said, look, there were 9 mRNA vaccines out there. Only 2 made it, right, to the real world. Whereas in The Atlantic suggesting, look, 13 non-mRNA vaccines have made it through trials and going through the period. So it's not inherent to mRNA that it's a success, that it's like 95% accurate. That's not inherent to mRNA. That's just happened to be a circumstance. And then looking at Novavax, saying Novavax is a traditional vaccine that probably has a higher percentage, because it's 90% in the current situation, whereas it was closer to 96% back in the first of the coronavirus. So all that being said, and basically the article is saying, look, Novavax is traditional, probably wouldn't have scared as many people. mRNA scared a lot of people. It was new. It has higher side effects than the traditional Novavax one. The Novavax is the real winner, and that we're really giving an unfair advantage to the mRNA. Can you speak into this? What's maybe resonates with you and what maybe might be nuanced?
Yeah, I think this is super interesting, because in some ways, you know, this sort of commentary about the vaccine is like totally predictable and good. It's essentially what the Atlantic is doing is they're getting ahead of the curve on the hype cycle. Are you familiar with the hype cycle?
No.
It's this idea. Look it up on Wikipedia. They've got this nice sort of graph of it, and it has these axes of basically enthusiasm or expectations for a technology and time. And as you move forward, you have this new technology and it just spikes at the very beginning. Everybody's super excited about this new technology. It's going to save the world. It's going to do everything. It's going to, you know, and then it plateaus, and then you reach this sort of trough of disillusionment, as they call it, where it's like, oh no, you know, we've tried applying this to a new problem and it's actually not working and it's more complicated than we thought. And then actually it picks up again, and then you reach sort of this plateau of realistic appropriate use of a new technology, right? Where it's no longer as good as you once thought.
That sounds like dating, Stephen.
Yeah, I guess it's true.
It's like, it's like best foot forward. Oh, we realize who we really are. We're broken people. Then we plateau. Okay, we love each other for who we are now.
Right. So, yeah, there you go. Exactly. It's like deep psychological realities here.
Totally.
Yeah, it's like, so I think that this is part of what's happening here. But I think we can break it down specifically with respect to the mRNA vaccines and the other vaccines that we have available. So I love this point that the article brought up that you just mentioned about how had this Novavax vaccine been trialed at the same time as the mRNA vaccines, it might have actually had higher efficacy. And so I think that what this really underscores is that these numbers of efficacy are not fixed numbers necessarily. You know, they're like we were talking about before, they're context specific. We need to know sort of how they were measured, when they were measured, why they were measured. And, you know, vaccines that are being trialed now are generally being trialed against variants that didn't exist 6 months ago when some of the earlier vaccines were being trialed. And so if we're comparing like with like in the current conditions, yeah, they do seem to be pretty well on par. Of course, there's some statistical uncertainty in here too, you know, depending on which geographic communities you're measuring this in. Just, you know, how many cases do you actually see? And you know, you're absolutely going to get some statistical variation in these numbers as well. And so my sense is that the confidence intervals for these efficacy rates, given the current conditions, do overlap pretty well with Novavax versus the mRNA vaccines, which is great. Other things to speak into here. So I do still think that the mRNA vaccines, that absolutely in many ways there was luck serendipity behind why they sort of were the first ones through the gate and why they were so effective. Some of it does pertain to the technology itself, though, too, in the sense that, you know, the Moderna vaccine, and I think the Pfizer vaccine as well, we actually had vials of it within days of when the sequence of the coronavirus was first published. Now, it still had to go through lots of testing. Many other companies also had vials of a coronavirus vaccine within days of that sequence being posted, but those ones didn't actually end up performing very well, or they had too severe side effects or whatever. So, but one of the great advantages of the mRNA vaccines is that you can produce them extremely quickly. And so they can be part of a very agile response. And so that was part of the reason why they were first through the gate, because just technologically speaking, and this is building off of, you know, years and years of development of other types of mRNA technology. We were just sort of at this time in history when mRNA vaccines, we were able to produce them, and something about the vaccines themselves make them sort of easier to produce quickly than other types of vaccine technology that we have available. So that's part of why they were first through the gate. But in terms of efficacy, I don't think that we can necessarily, I don't think it's necessarily true that mRNA vaccines will always be super effective. That's super pathogen specific. It could just be that COVID-19 is a decently vaccinable pathogen, and some pathogens are more vaccinable. And so, you know, of course, the canonical example here is HIV, where we still don't have a vaccine, and we've been working on that for years and years and years. Are mRNA vaccines going to finally give us a vaccine for HIV? I hope so, but I don't think there's any reason to think that will necessarily change the landscape there. Nor do I think that necessarily mRNA vaccines will be more effective against other pathogens that we already have vaccines for. I just don't know. They could, and I really hope that they do. But again, when we're thinking about COVID, it's this, there's the vaccine, but it's the vaccine pathogen interaction that's really important here. And that can totally change depending on what the pathogen is, what body systems the pathogen interacts with, all of these things. So mRNA vaccines, super exciting. There are reasons why they can be part of this agile response to emerging pathogens. They could really revolutionize the way that we deal with infectious diseases, but they won't necessarily. And I think that's part of what this article was getting at, was that a lot of enthusiasm around mRNA vaccines, but I think it's worth tempering some of that because we still have a lot of big challenges to face. And in many ways, we're lucky that they were as effective as they were against this particular pathogen. Hopefully that success will translate into other pathogens in the future. But generally speaking, when we think about medical technology, you know, oftentimes, you know, the real ringer sort of emerges to the surface for one infectious disease, and we think it's going to cure everything. And then we apply it in a different context, and it's like, it's just okay. And I think that's probably the most likely scenario, is that it'll help, but we'll see what the actual impact will be.
Great. Thanks for that, Stephen. I think we'll end there on that. Check out Novavax as well. A lot of good stuff coming with that one. Obviously, way more available to the global community then. Thank you, Stephen. Now, again, just if you want to leave a review, please do. Apple Podcasts to support us. Patreon.com/pandemicpodcast or Venmo, PayPal. Realize that we may not have an episode next week unless I can get Mark on. The week after that, I will be on vacation, at least a staycation, so there could be a 1 to 2 week sabbatical, but we'll negotiate that as time comes forward. We are still here, and we're still going to be going and giving you the news on the pandemic and just general information on the future of healthcare and disease and all that good stuff. So stay tuned. Have a wonderful week. Have a great 4th if we don't come in on that week, and we'll see you soon. Take care, and bye-bye. Before you head off, I just have one small favor to ask of you. If there's anybody in your life that you can think of, two people that might really could use this Living the Real podcast, would you share it with them this week? I'd greatly appreciate it. Somebody in your life, like, man, they could just use a deeper perspective, right? Maybe a calling to a bigger purpose, or maybe they just need a better plan in their life. Share with them. Give them the hope that they need to be able to get out of whatever they need to get into, to be inspired to do something great. So if you can think of two people in your life right now who could use a little bit more of a realness in their week, please share it with them. Take care. Bye-bye.